Good afternoon and welcome to the Senior Statesman of Virginia's October program. We have an exciting candidates forum for you today. I'm Jeff Gould, president, and it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator for today, Bob Beard. Bob is a former anchor for CBS 19 and formerly also in the DC area. So Bob, it's all yours. Take it away.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. We really appreciate everybody for joining us here for our third and final candidate forum, Zoom. This time, unfortunately, we wish we were in person at the center, but as you know, the pandemic is unfortunately still with us all. So we want to welcome our candidates in District 57, which includes mainly the city of Charlottesville, a little bit of Albemarle. Incumbent delegate Sally Hudson, a Democrat, is facing challenger Philip Andrew Hamilton, a Republican. And in District 59, which includes part of southern Albemarle all the way down to Campbell County, we have incumbent delegate Matt Ferris, a Republican of Campbell County, is facing Democratic challenger Ben Moses and challenger Louis Sicily, an independent. We have 2 minutes worth of opening statements, and we're going to go numerically according to district. We're going to begin with District 57 and delegate Sally Hudson. Sally.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Beard. Thank you to everyone at the Senior Statesman for organizing this event and to everyone who's tuning in. My name is Sally Hudson, and for the last 2 years, I've been serving Albemarle and Charlottesville in the Virginia House of Delegates. And I know it's been quite a stretch for all of us these last 2 years. So it's worth reflecting on just how far we've come in Virginia in those 2 years. When I was sworn into the House in January 2020, Virginia ranked among the worst states in the country for voter suppression. And 2 years later, we've become a nationwide beacon for voting rights. We've expanded early voting, adopted automatic registration, and passed our own state voting rights act so that every Virginia voter is protected no matter who sits in DC. 2 years ago, Virginia lagged behind our neighbors in clean energy investment too. We're now top five in the nation for new wind and solar projects. And in just 2 years, the General Assembly has passed a host of overdue reforms that Virginians have demanded for years. We've raised the minimum wage, passed universal background checks, expanded reproductive health care, adopted workplace protections for pregnant and nursing mothers, and abolished the death penalty. We've begun overhauling centuries of unjust criminal laws. We've empowered our local public employees, our teachers and our bus drivers and our first responders to have a meaningful voice on the job. And we're just getting started. So I look forward to joining our discussion today about all the good work that we've done in those 2 years and how we can keep it up in the days ahead.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hudson. We want to ask all of our candidates to keep their opening statements and all their answers in the Q&A to 2 minutes. We're going to go now to our challenger, Philip Andrew Hamilton, a Republican. Mr. Hamilton.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having me on this panel today. My name is Philip Andrew Hamilton. I'm a proud historian, a fighter for liberty, and I will take the fight to the establishment, the political establishment, whether it be the Republican or the Democratic Party. I'm going to call them both out. I'm going to start off with a quote from my relative, George Mason IV. He once said, "In all our associations, in all our agreements, let us never lose sight of this fundamental maxim that all power was originally lodged in and derived from the people." And that's something that we should remember for people who are in political office and those who are voting at the polls. Power is derived from the people. And what do the people want now? They want term limits, not just for the Virginia governor. They want term limits for House of Delegates, Senate, school board, mayor, board of supervisor, and other local seats. We must limit the power of politicians instead of politicians limiting the power of the people beneath them. So we must change the narrative in that regard. We got to fight for our Second Amendment rights. I support constitutional carry, like Texas and other states support. And I think we needed to pass that here in Virginia. I want to get rid of COVID-19 restrictions and limit the executive power of the governor to shut down schools, churches, and businesses. Together, we can fight for a better Virginia, and I'm hoping to have the vote of the people here in the 57th district.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamilton. We're going to go now to District 59 and begin with the incumbent delegate, Republican Matt Ferris. Mr. Ferris.
Good morning to everyone. Really appreciate everybody getting on today and taking their time to join us. It's a beautiful day here in Campbell County. I really have enjoyed representing the people of 59th District for 10 years. And I originally started on the Ag Committee, Militia, Police, and Finance. And I think we got a lot done when the Republicans win control that are important to the people in the 59th District. And I'm really proud of my time there. When I was the chairman of the Firearms Committee. And of course, that was something I enjoyed as an avid outdoorsman, hunter, and protector of the Second Amendment. And then after the Democrats took control 2 years ago, the speaker put me on appropriations and militia and police. And I'm very proud of my time there the last 2 years with the Democrats in control. The speaker and I have had a good working relationship. The day that she was the first day of session, she was made speaker. I told her that I was going to have to do a lot of things that I didn't like to do. She's a vegetarian, and I told her that we had beef that day. Of course, I'm a beef cattle farmer, and I told her I would like for her to eat some beef. And she said, you know, I'm a vegetarian. And I said, well, I'm probably going to have to eat some things the next 2 years I don't like. You need to start by setting a good example. But we get along very well. And I was on the conference committee for a lot of important things over the last 2 years. And I really am proud of my ability to work across the aisle and to have an open mind. My predecessor, Watkins Abbott, had a famous saying that I love, and that's that I reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. And the speaker had me on the conference committee for minimum wage. And that was something very important to everybody in Virginia, especially businesses, small businesses. And I was very proud of that. And very proud of the fact that she put me on a joint committee on health care. And the last 2 years, you can imagine how important that's been during the pandemic and the discussions we've had and continue to have in the working group what we've accomplished and what we intend to accomplish in these trying times with health care where it is today. And again, I really appreciate everybody being on today. Appreciate y'all having me and appreciate your time and look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Delegate Ferris. We're going to go to Democrat, his challenger now, Dr. Ben Moses. Mr. Moses, Dr. Moses.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you, everybody else, for being here. It's an honor to be on with this group today. My name is Dr. Benjamin Moses. I am a United States Army veteran and a critical care physician. I served in the U.S. Army for 10 years. I worked with soldiers in three different states. I took care of thousands of soldiers, largely the severely wounded and injured from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and focusing on many times their transition out of the military and into civilian service. As I transitioned out of the military into civilian service myself, I am an anesthesiologist and an intensive care unit doctor. And over the course of the last 2 years, I have been working at the bedside with people and their families stricken with the coronavirus and the COVID-19 syndrome. I've seen the ways that this pandemic has stolen so much from people and their families. I've seen the ways that people's lives have been changed forever. I've seen many people, unfortunately, lose their battles and die. And I've seen the ways that people have been harmed so greatly by not even, in many cases, being able to be with their family members as they've been sick in these last 2 years. My wife and I are both physicians. We're raising two kids here in Central Virginia, and I'm very proud of my friends and neighbors that I look forward to representing here. With my background, obviously, in medicine for the last 20 years, serving people as a physician, both in the military, in the veteran healthcare system, and in the civilian world. I know that my voice is desperately needed in the House of Delegates. Currently, out of 100 delegates, we have zero physicians. And so I think it is incredibly important. It is critical to our survival as a Commonwealth, to the health and safety of ourselves and our families, that we have voices, expert voices like mine at the table, ensuring that every Virginian is safe.
All right, thank you, Dr. Moses. Now to, in District 59 again, independent challenger Louis Sicily. Mr. Sicily.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for having me on today. I've lived in Virginia for over 50 years. Grew up in Virginia pretty much my whole life. Moved to Northern Virginia, where I was a police officer with the Fairfax County Police Department. I was also a volunteer fireman with Dale City, as a volunteer, as I mentioned. And back in Lynchburg again, and I'm a business owner in the Timberlake area. And my main goal is to work with small businesses, work with the teachers or our local communities, and work on getting them pay raises, and really try to work on getting the small business back up and running, because we all know that Virginia has taken a pretty big hit with small businesses. And I feel like if we don't get something going with those, pretty soon our communities are going to suffer even more than they have been, as they already have. So, and again, my main goal is to work with the communities, work with the business owners and school teachers, and really make an impact in our district. I feel like it needs it. It's been long overdue. And again, I'm a big believer in the police departments and first responders in the military. So I support them. I consider myself a conservative, and that's what I'm looking at doing. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sicily. This is for everybody. As you know, the COVID pandemic is the big story that's affecting everybody's lives right now. I noticed something today from the Kaiser Family Foundation, which says almost 50,000 coronavirus deaths in the U.S. would have been prevented with vaccinations. What does everybody think about how the Commonwealth of Virginia is doing when it comes to responding to the coronavirus? Could the General Assembly do anything differently next year? And let's begin with Delegate Hudson.
Well, thanks very much for the question. I think that all our minds put COVID at the top of the list, because until we treat our public health crisis, we can't confront its many echoes in the other facets of our lives. I think across the board, the Commonwealth has been rolling out our vaccinations well. We've been fortunate to have a physician as our governor who has put public health first in that way. And I think if you compare the rate of vaccination in Virginia to our regional peers, I think that bears out in the numbers. I think that the General Assembly can do some things to assist with the vaccine rollout, but it's important to remember that we have a part-time General Assembly. And so the GA is not in session for most of the year. We have a very powerful executive by design, and most of the rollout of those administrative procedures largely sits with executive agencies. So the role of the General Assembly in supporting the governor in rolling out the vaccine is first and foremost to communicate from our communities when we've had challenges with the rollout. And I've been very close contact with Dr. Avula, who headed up the vaccine rollout in Virginia, about our needs here in the Blue Ridge Health District. And then to also be good public health communicators ourselves, to make sure that we make sure all of our residents know where they can get their vaccine, where they can get reliable information about their choice to be vaccinated. And I like to think I've also done that as well. In fact, if anybody's listening right now, know that I believe as of this week, our major community health center is now back up and running in Seminole Square. So you can get vaccinated 6 days a week, walk in if you still need your first shots, or if you're ready for your boosters. I think that's our job as public servants.
All right, thank you, Delegate Hudson. Mr. Hamilton, sir.
So Hudson and I, we have a distinctly different opinion on this. Personally, I have not been vaccinated. I do not plan on getting vaccinated anytime in the near future. I actually had COVID-19 earlier this year. I recovered naturally, and I had a high level of vitamin D, zinc, B6, B12 in my blood. And there's studies that show that people with higher levels of vitamin D and zinc and other vitamins that increase your individual immunity are more likely to have less severe symptoms of COVID-19 and are more likely to recover from it. So I think the government has been wrong all along. We need to change our food stamp program so that way you can purchase vitamins in addition to food. So that way those who are living in poverty are more likely to boost their immunity to fight off this virus. Now, I'm not going to say that folks shouldn't get the vaccine. That's your choice. I've chosen not to. I'm not going to tell other people not to, but I believe in the freedom of medical choice, and we have to respect that. I want to put an end to these mandates. And an interesting thing I like to point out is that yesterday I tried to go to the former minority leader's Toscano's book signing at the Paramount Theater, and I was denied because I didn't have a vaccine card to show to them. And when you have natural immunity, that should count for something. And I would mandate it so that way businesses do count natural immunity for something. This is something that Dr. Rand Paul has mentioned and many other doctors as well. So we have to change the narrative regarding to how we fight this pandemic.
Dr. Moses, how are we doing on the pandemic right now? And what would you do to try and alleviate it in the months and years going forward?
Well, I can tell you from the bedside, you know, there are things that I have seen in the last year and a half that are things I never hoped to see. I've seen people young and old succumb to this horrendous disease. I've seen people, those who survive, end up with severe symptoms for months. And at this point, while I've been able to see some of the peaks and troughs in as far as our case numbers go, we're still very much dealing with this pandemic right now. It's a very real part of every community that I've been aware of here in Virginia. And I think that the evidence in support of vaccines is definitive. You know, at this point, there have been billions of doses of vaccines administered around the world. And I think that overall, we now know that it is not only safe, but an effective means of decreasing the overall morbidity and mortality of the COVID-19 syndrome. I think that one of the things that we continue to see is a lot of hesitancy around the way that people get information about this vaccine. I think if you look historically, vaccines have been an important part of both health and economic recovery from a lot of different conditions over our nation's history. If you look back to polio, we got rid of polio through vaccination. If you look at smallpox, we got rid of smallpox through vaccination. You know, those incredibly horrible diseases that we had in our nation's history, we never achieved herd immunity with those things. We actually did get past them with vaccinations. I'm hopeful that in the conversations that I have with people, they can see past the politicization of this particular disease process, because as a physician, I see this just as a disease that hurts people, that hurts their families, and that unfortunately has led to so much turmoil in our country over the last 2 years. I think specifically here in Virginia, our governor and our health departments have done a good job of rolling out the vaccine. I think that our vaccination numbers here in Central Virginia are spotty in some places compared to others. And I think if anything, that has more to do with the ways that rural Virginia healthcare access has been overlooked and ignored for generations. And so I think that the way forward is to make sure that we are addressing a lot of those deficits to health access to ensure that people have, you know, up-to-date information, not only on what is effective and safe, but also in how to get to those health pieces of healthcare.
All right, thank you, Dr. Moses. Delegate Ferris, is the Commonwealth doing enough, in your opinion, to fight the pandemic? Is it too polarizing, politically polarizing right now?
Well, you know, I agree with a lot of people that don't take the vaccine or don't want their children to take it, that this vaccine was created it's been created in a very short term. First off, I want to thank Dr. Moses, not only for his time in service in the military, but for his time on the front line working with COVID and all the other frontline workers. You know, until the COVID-19 affected me personally when somebody I knew had gotten sick with it and died. I was skeptical, but this has been awful. It's been terrible on the healthcare workers. I myself am vaccinated. I think anybody that can get vaccinated should get vaccinated. I think it's awful. I think it would be awful to get sick, go to the hospital, and a healthcare worker get sick because they were trying to make me better. And in the case that I know that first affected me, take it back to their family, and their family gets sick and die from it. I think it is very selfish for someone to expect people to, and when we get sick, we expect to go to the hospital and somebody take care of us, and that's what the hell I want. And I'd hate to get somebody else sick and they lose their life, especially an innocent bystander like a family member. And so I was very disappointed in the terrible job our governor did in the very beginning. It looked like he didn't take this as serious as he should have, and I would think that he had a better knowledge than I did, and a lot of people did. But you know, this country left a dictatorship, became a democracy, and a lot of men and women suffered and died so that we could become a democracy. And the governor's position has been almost dictatorship, and that's been very disappointing too. If we do anything as a General Assembly, if we could set some guidelines to help our healthcare workers and to support them, I think we have had an awful time with this in this pandemic. I don't know if how many people are aware that the mental hospitals, the state mental hospitals, quit taking patients because they were overloaded. Well, they were overloaded because people were suffering so with this pandemic. And then, I mean, who could think of a worse atrocity than mental hospitals not taking patients? What happens to them? The people that need help is mental health is just like somebody that has a serious wound or cancer. Anything, it's the same illness, the same type of illness as any other illness someone gets. So it's been a tough time in the state of Virginia, and I really want to thank our police departments and the sheriff's departments, the police.
Thank you, Delegate Ferris. Thank you, Delegate. We appreciate it. Two-minute answers, everybody, if we could. Let's go to Mr. Mr. Sicily, quickly, how do you what do you think about the COVID response in Virginia?
Yes, sir. I think Virginia has done a fairly good job. Communication always can be better. Letting people know where to go and putting more stuff to where people can actually access is a big, big deal. I personally have not been vaccinated, but I personally never have had the flu shot and never had the flu either. I think it's a person's choice. I don't think anything should be mandated on anybody when it comes to the health of themselves or their children. And I agree. I mean, and with a lot of you, if you want to get vaccinated, that's your choice. If you feel like that will help you and be the right thing for you, that's your choice. But I don't believe in mandating anybody to get the shot. And that's just my opinion. So,
okay, we're going to shift away from the COVID pandemic right now and go to a couple of questions. Here's one from from somebody who wrote me an email who lives in the 59th district. If you're elected to the House of Delegates, what would your top legislative priority be come January of 2022? And we'll begin with Delegate Hudson.
Thanks, Mr. Beard. Well, I think that our top legislative priority in the next governor's administration has to be providing better funding for our public schools and for our public healthcare workers, because we've seen both of those essential services stretched far too thin in the last 2 years. When I meet every week with teachers and nurses and physicians in our community, they tell me that Richmond says a lot about how they're frontline heroes, but doesn't put meaningful support behind them. So our mental health care workers, our nurses, our teachers, our speech pathologists, all of those critical public servants are not paid enough and not resourced enough to be able to do their jobs like the professionals that they are. Our nurses have caseloads that are way too high. Our teachers have classrooms that are way too full. And that was all true before the pandemic, but the pandemic has only stretched them more thin. And that is something the General Assembly can control. You know, we don't set the funding for a lot of higher education, but we absolutely set the funding for K through 12 education. And we absolutely set the reimbursement rates for our home care workers, for a lot of our hospital nurses, for absolutely for our mental health hospitals. And so we've been doing more than a decade of belt tightening in Richmond since the last recession. That support never fully recovered. And it's high time that we put our full financial support and not just our words behind those people who we identify as critical servants.
Thank you, Ms. Hudson. Mr. Hamilton, sir.
Yes. So what my first priority would be term limits. I think we need to have an amendment to the Virginia Constitution to have term limits for state and local offices. Also support the Article 5 Convention of States. What this will do is this will call for a convention, so then we'll have term limits on Congress. So you have your congressman, congresswoman, and your senators will have term limits. And also support term limits for U.S. Supreme Court justices. And many folks, Republicans, Democrats, independents, other third-party individuals, all support term limits. This is a winning issue, and this will be on the top of my priority. Second, what I'll do is I would advocate for a law that would allow the state of Virginia to sue any locality that removes historical monuments. What we've seen, this destruction of our history, is a Marxist movement. Nothing short of that. Instead of tearing down our history, we should be creating. I went and saw the Freedom and Emancipation Monument just this last weekend at the Richmond Folk Festival. And it shows a black man who's breaking the bonds of slavery with a woman carrying a child behind her. We should be focusing on creation and not destruction. And I proposed adding statues dedicated to Union soldiers. In Charlottesville, we could have added monuments dedicated to the 68 Unionists who fought as sailors, as soldiers, and they all went to the University of Virginia. We could have had a statue dedicated to United States colored troops, but the city council decided to not do that. We could have had statues dedicated to Ulysses S. Grant, but no. Sally Hudson has decided to just destroy our history and not build upon it. Another priority of mine is limiting the power of the governor to shut down our schools, businesses, and churches. And another priority would be funding our police. The Democrats voted to get rid of a $5,000 pay bonus for all police officers in this August special session. I would never vote to defund the police. If we expect more from them, we got to give them the funding that they deserve.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Delegate Ferris, your priorities, if indeed you get reelected and come back in 2022?
Well, you know, that's a big question. If I get elected, and it depends on who's in control, if I get elected, that it'll also make a big difference in what we can get done and what we can't get done. But I think no matter who wins and who's in control, I think that the as a state, we need to really focus on healthcare workers and what we're doing, what we can do for them and what we can do to help them. Elderly care is something that is becoming more and more prominent and will become more prominent. And I think that that's certainly a part of the healthcare that I want to focus on. Our police departments need some help. Law enforcement is really in a terrible situation. They're in a bind like I could not imagine. And they're a big part of that, this rural district. The only thing we have is our sheriff's departments. A lot of times there's not paid volunteer fire departments. And I mean, there's only volunteer fire departments and rescue squads. That's something that I want to focus on. And our schools, it seems to be such a hot topic right now. Definitely something needs to be done about our schools.
I thank you, Delegate Perez. Dr. Moses, your top priorities if you get elected.
Thank you. And I have to appreciate Delegate Ferris's comment on the importance of healthcare. You know, as a physician working in the hospital, I've seen this as a significant issue, but also in the time that I've spent going all over my district, I've talked to voters in Campbell County and Nelson and Appomattox and Buckingham and Albemarle County. And I think one of the most consistent concerns that the voters have, and something that I think takes priority, is broadband infrastructure throughout Virginia. I think that the reality is that over the last year and a half, we've seen how not only how important it is to be connected, but how much worse certain problems are when people are not connected. We've seen, unfortunately, people have less access to healthcare because of their inability to get telehealth visits. We've seen worsen access to educational resources, students having to go to a nearby fast food restaurant parking lot to be able to use their Wi-Fi in order to do their homework. We've seen small businesses crumble and in some cases fail because they weren't able to move their markets online or reach out for additional resources through the internet. And we have places like Buckingham County where only 40% of homes have access to high speed.
Hi, we may have some issues with Dr. Moses's Zoom. Can everybody not hear him?
Yeah, it went out.
I think he's illustrating a priority problem.
Okay.
First one.
That's okay.
Am I back on?
Yes, Dr. Moses.
and there we go.
A couple of seconds, okay? Thank you.
I was talking about broadband and the importance of broadband. And if anything, this underscores, you know, our ability to communicate with people. In order for people to get access to healthcare, access to schooling, and access to business opportunities, we have to have a definitive and stable broadband infrastructure throughout the Commonwealth. And that would be probably my top priority.
All right, thank you, Dr. Moses. Mr. Sicily, your time.
Yes, sir. I want to thank Dr. Moses for bringing that up because that is a big one on my list is broadband. While out talking to local law enforcement, and I found out something that I wasn't aware of, that most of their radios they use on a day-to-day basis for their job don't pick up in certain areas. And to me, being in former law enforcement, that's a priority to have is your radio at all times. So broadband is definitely a big concern. Schools, I heard Mr. The gentleman talking, Hamilton, mentioned it about the schools. I think it was him that said the schools need the raises. The teachers need raises. Our police departments need raises. And I know they're not. I mean, I've sat down and talked with them one-on-one, and a lot of those people are struggling and trying to get from, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And it shouldn't be that way. These are people in our communities that's doing these jobs that not a lot of people could do or want to do. So raises for the schools, for the teachers, definitely raises for police departments and first responders. I know there are some fire departments in our area that are paid firemen, and I've done that job as well. And that's not an easy job. And, you know, I salute all of them that do it as a volunteer because, again, it's a very, very hard job. So those are my goals as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sicily. The Q&A section of Zoom is open. So if you have any questions, please go to the Q&A and ask them. I'm going to ask a couple of questions here from our Zoom audience. One is for Mr. Hamilton. Mr. Hamilton says he believes in individual choice for medical decisions, i.e. did not get the vaccination. How does this square with your anti-abortion stance?
Interesting. All right. Well, I knew that was going to be coming up at some point, right? Well, I think Governor Northam, you know, he's a physician. He was wrong to state that doctors can kill a child after they're born. Personally, I would make it a felony for any doctor to violate the Hippocratic Oath and to kill a child after they're born. I think that's absolutely disgraceful. And government has a duty to protect life, liberty, and property under the social contract theory. So these are things that we have to remember. And the New York Assembly, they cheered when they passed a law that would allow for abortions into the third trimester. We can't forget the humanity of those who are not yet born. And certainly I would keep restrictions in place that bar third trimester abortions. So that is my stance on that issue.
Okay, we're going to go to another question from a member of the audience. She would like to know what each candidate will do to promote small businesses in the Commonwealth. Of course, a lot of businesses are having trouble getting workers right now because of the pandemic. Millions of people quit their jobs in the last couple of weeks, we learned from the unemployment numbers. Let's talk about that with, we're going to start with Delegate Hudson. Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Beard. Well, I think it's a critical question, especially in communities like ours that are outside of the major urban centers that are dominated by the largest corporations in Virginia. I know that a lot of people are eager to tout Virginia as the best state for business. I might suggest that it's the best state for big business, that we do a lot to tip the scale currently in the Virginia state code toward the largest corporations and against the small businesses that are really the lifeblood of our communities. And I've been a really active advocate for our small business owners and to put them on an even playing field. That starts with lowering the cost of doing business in Virginia. We've got a lot of red tape and inefficient public services, public agencies that our small businesses have to interface with. I think of the Virginia Employment Commission coming to the top of mind lately, just how tricky it is to file that paperwork. So I think that there's a lot of work that we can be doing in a sincerely bipartisan way to make those interactions between small businesses and government more efficient so that we have the kind of appropriate oversight, but also not undue hurdles that keep you from carrying out your work. The other critical piece, I think, of supporting our small businesses is supporting our educational institutions and creating those really tight relationships between business owners and the workforce that they need to thrive. I think we're really fortunate here in Central Virginia to have a thriving community college in PVCC. I think that they're doing an excellent job in staying in close contact with our employers so that they're investing in the programs that people need most in growing industries, whether that's in our technical trades, in our healthcare professions, in the clean energy industry, which is growing dramatically. I think the combination of those two are part of our solution for supporting our small business owners.
Okay, thank you, Delegate Hudson. Dr. Moses, what would you do to help support small business?
Well, I think that first and foremost, right now we're still in a crisis. You know, we're looking at the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's something that's touched everybody in one way or another. I think that the biggest hurdle to clear in order to see a profound, robust, and durable recovery of small business is actually getting past the COVID-19 pandemic. A big part of the reason why we have a worker shortage is because there's so many people who have personally been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic in some ways, either because of their health or because of the health of a family member. I think another big part of that is ensuring that Virginians have access to paid sick leave and paid family and medical leave. We shouldn't be in a position where people are being punished for being sick. And I think that small businesses have been particularly affected by the inability of people to keep their jobs in that way. Specifically to Central Virginia, and in part to the point that Delegate Hudson was making, our small businesses in Central Virginia are small farms. Farmers desperately need help here. And I think that the ways in which our small farmers have been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic is palpable in every aspect of life. So ensuring that it's not just big business that's at the table talking about ways to get past this, it's small business and farmers from Central Virginia that are at the table helping to make pave our path forward.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Moses. Delegate Ferris, what would you do to help small business in Virginia?
You know, I agree with Dr. Moses. I'm a farmer and I understand exactly what he's talking about. In the 59th district, the agriculture is so important. And that was one reason that I had a hard time, didn't vote for the budget a couple times in committees because of the internet connection. I was in support of cellular or satellite type connections where we have even with hardwire internet, if I'm not connected to it, out in the field, I can't correspond, be a part of some business meetings like I, like we're having today. And, I think it will work towards that, hopefully more in the future. But, the biggest thing is I think we need to roll back some of the restrictions that we've put on small businesses. We've made it very hard for small businesses to function with all the restrictions that we put on them. And that's something that I look forward as the Republicans hopefully take control of the House and maybe win back the governorship this time that we can do.
All right. Thank you, Delegate Ferris. Mr. Sicily.
Yes, sir. I mean, I'm a big believer in getting people back to work. I think that that's the biggest part or the biggest problem we have right now. I talked to a lot of business owners, and many of the business owners say they can't get anybody to work, even though they're willing to pay $15 an hour and more. I think the first thing we need to do is put a halt on giving out this money for all these people that could go back to work and could find jobs and get them back in the workforce to help build these small businesses up. Because there's a lot of restaurants that are closing 2 and 3 days a week now because they can't find servers at $15 an hour or whatever the case is. And it's disturbing that we're allowing it to happen. And we keep putting out more and more money and these people don't want to work at that point. And we got to fix it. We got to start from there is what we need to do.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sicily. Mr. Hamilton, your vision for small businesses helping them in Virginia.
Well, I agree with Sicily. We have to start cutting off some of these unemployment benefits, because I've actually met people who said, well, only reason I'm not working right now is because the government's just extending it and they keep on extending it. So I'm just choosing not to work. And there are people who are taking advantage of this pandemic so that way they can stay at home and work under the cover with cash only jobs and other means. So we have to reevaluate the unemployment system, and we need to get folks back to work. And I've been to several restaurants who are closing early. There was a restaurant, the Fox Cafe in Charlottesville. They actually went out of business after 27 years. Why? They had enough customers, but they didn't have enough workers to stay in business. And the owner had health issues, and she was forced to shut down the business. This is a catastrophe. And another way we can help small business is if we have a Republican attorney general that we file a lawsuit against Joe Biden's administration regarding the vaccine mandates imposed on businesses with 100 or more employees. And we have to make it optional. The reason why we're having a shortage in addition to the unemployment extension is because people are getting fired because they're being forced to take a vaccine that they don't want to take. And they have to respect medical choice. So to help small businesses and to retain people, we need to get rid of these mandates and make the vaccine optional.
Mr. Beard.
Sally.
As the economist on the call, I do feel compelled to note that federal unemployment benefits ended a month ago.
Yes, they did.
The fact that we have not yet seen a recovery in employment is a clear sign that it wasn't the unemployment benefits that were keeping people out of work. It is very much what Dr. Moses said, which is that there are other reasons why people are not yet able to return to work. Many of them childcare related, because they aren't yet able to leave their children at home, or because they don't feel safe in service sector jobs because there are people who are still unvaccinated, and many customers who aren't treating them well, just on a person-to-person basis. So I think that it's high time we put away the boogeyman of unemployment benefits and recognize that there are many things keeping people away from certain service sector jobs right now.
Mr. Hamilton, how do you respond to that?
Well, it's like I said before, you know, these businesses are hurting. And yes, there are some people who are choosing not to work because of health concerns. And that's understandable if that's the case. But I have personally met people who are milking the system. And that's we really extend these benefits for far too long. So I won't take back anything I said regards to that.
Okay. We're going to talk about guns right now. I've got a question for Dr. Moses. It says hunting and Second Amendment rights are very important in Buckingham, Nelson, Campbell counties, et cetera. What is your Second Amendment stance?
Thank you very much for that question. So my family actually raises hunting dogs in Virginia. And I know that this is something that is near and dear to the hearts and livelihoods of many people. I think that this is something that is safely enjoyed by many families. And I don't have any interest in changing that culture. As far as my own personal experience with weapons, I was trained as an expert marksman in the United States Army. I'm very familiar with handguns, with rifles, with machine guns, with bazookas, with tanks. I'm familiar with a lot of different types of firepower, and I was trained on how to use them. That said, I'm also a physician, and I've treated many people with explosives injuries, with gun injuries. And I think that's important that while we recognize individuals' rights to own weapons as protected by the United States Constitution, we also recognize that there are ways that we can work together to keep people safer, to ensure that our families, that our kids are not accidentally or unintentionally harmed with firearms.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Moses. Here's a question. Right now, there are approximately, this is for everybody, right now there are approximately 13,000 people with disabilities waiting for Medicaid waiver slots in Virginia. What would each candidate do to address this massive wait list and support those with disabilities in getting needed services? I did not know anything about this. Let's begin with Delegate Hudson.
I think it's a critical question, and I'm so glad that we spent a full hour on this topic in a forum last week with the ARC of the Piedmont, which provides such critical services for our community. I think that this fits right along with the shortage of funding in healthcare more broadly that we talked about earlier. So to get really to the point, how do we provide more funding for Medicaid waivers? We have to have a conversation about either cutting other wasteful spending or raising revenue. And I think I've shown a track record for doing both of those in my first 2 years in office. Last year, I carried a bill to close a loophole, which was propping up coal facilities in Virginia that are no longer generating either money or clean energy or jobs. And I've also pushed to close many loopholes in corporate taxation, which are preventing big businesses that do business in multiple states from sending their fair share of revenue back to Virginia. Ultimately, if we want to have a conversation about how we raise salaries for public employees, about how we end the Medicaid waiver list, that is a conversation about how do we raise state revenue. And so any serious answer to that conversation has to describe what do you want to cut from the current state budget, or how do you plan to raise revenue? My primary tactic has been to close many of the loopholes that currently put a thumb on the scale for big business, leaving our public services underfunded and disadvantaging our small businesses.
Thank you, Delegate Ferris. What do you do about 13,000 people with disabilities waiting for Medicaid waiver slots in Virginia? How do you raise the money to deal with that?
Well, Bob, I first want to say that Medicaid is the largest portion of our state budget. What we spend in medical care in Virginia is the largest part of our budget by far. And I want to remind my opponent that Dr. Roxanne Robinson is still in the House, and Dr. Dawn Adams, who happens to be a dear friend of mine, one of my best friends, not only in the House, but personally. She represents Monument Avenue, so I guess that tells us what party she's in. But, you know, we have to, it's tough to say, to pick and choose who gets what. But people with disabilities, I had an uncle that lived with me my whole childhood. And after I moved out as a grown man, lived with me, that had disabilities. And they are people I really care about. And I want to do all I can to support them. And there just comes a point where there just isn't enough money. And my opponent ran an ad talking about I voted against limiting how much the copay was for diabetics. Well, that bill was a feel-good bill. I hate to say a lot of my Republican friends. In fact, I was the only one out of 99 people that voted against it. But when we limit the copay, the insurance companies then have to pay for it. And so until we get back to the pharmaceutical companies that are gouging us and do something about that, that's something that I look forward to working towards and coming forward.
Your opponent, Dr. Moses.
So when talking about a number as kind of astonishing as 13,000 people waiting for Medicaid waivers, I think back to some of the situations that I've been a part of. For example, when I was on active duty in the United States Army, there was a front page article in the Washington Post in 2007 describing some of the conditions that injured, wounded, ill, and injured soldiers were being kept in while they were waiting to receive services. And it was a huge black eye for the United States military and for our healthcare services. And as much as it was embarrassing for the people at the top, it stimulated a lot of change in the way that we cared for our soldiers and their families. 10 years later, there was a similarly horrendous uproar, but I think an appropriate uproar, I should say, but a loud cry for the way that veterans in this country were being treated through the VA system, that there were wait lists a year long, and the numbers of veterans who were dying on wait lists to receive care before they were able to receive care. The reality was that it was absolutely true. I worked in VA hospitals as a physician, and I saw that some of the veterans and how long they had to wait to get their care and how much worse disease was when there was a wait for it. And when it became very public that this was a problem, it stimulated change. I think that first and foremost, when we're talking about this issue with 13,000 people waiting for Medicaid waivers in the Commonwealth, really what we're talking about is delays in access to care. And what happens when you have delays in access to care is that disease burden gets worse and becomes far more difficult to treat and far more expensive. So overall, if we're talking about cost here, and this goes a little bit to what Delegate Hudson was talking about from an economic perspective, you're going to pay for it now or you're going to pay for it later. Right now in the Commonwealth, we spend an enormous amount of money. And I agree with what Delegate Ferris said as far as how much we spend on healthcare. But a lot of that is care at the emergency room level or at the very end of life. When we're talking about paying for Medicaid waivers, it's for people to get access to primary care services, to preventive care services, things that will actually overall decrease the disease burden in the Commonwealth and decrease the cost to every single taxpayer.
All right, thank you, Dr. Moses. Mr. Sicily, would you like to weigh in on getting 13,000 people off the Medicare waiver waiting list?
That's a very high number, and it's unacceptable. Things like this need to be looked into, and there should be things in place to fix issues like this. And I'm running as an independent because I see both parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, not getting along on many, many issues. And I think they need to step up and do what's right for the people and not always do what the party's telling them to do. And we need to fix this, and it needs to be done now. So, again, we need to put the parties aside in some of these things and really work for the people. And that's what I would do is get with both sides and say, we need a solution. We need to fix this now. What can we do in the best interest of the people? So,
Mr. Hamilton?
Well, 13,000, that number is far too high. Those are people who are in need. And yes, both parties do need to work together to address this issue. And another thing I want to loop in is that, I've supported marijuana legalization. I'm glad that it actually got legalized here in the state. And we need to expand the marijuana business in Virginia, the farms, dispensary, and other ways. And we can use money from that to help pay for some of the medical expenses here in Virginia. So we need to focus on how we bring marijuana and other businesses into Virginia so that way we can make sure that we tackle those 13,000 individuals and get those waivers granted for them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Here's another question from the Q&A. There's a chance that Virginia might have a divided government next year. How will each candidate work with the other side, Republicans working with Democrats in the other way, to continue getting things done for the Commonwealth? And let's begin with Delegate Hudson.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Reed, and thank you for the question. If you hop on the Virginia Public Access Project right now, vpap.org, you can look at the voting records of all the legislators. And if you hop in on the last legislative session and you look at the Democratic caucus, you'll find that I'm one of the top five most independent legislators in Richmond. I have a track record for taking every issue on its merits and working to do best by the people of our district, not to serve a particular party. I think that in particular bills that I worked on, I worked very closely with our Republican neighbor to the east, Delegate Ware from Powhatan, on reforming the way that our electricity utilities work so we can lower those bills for working families and for businesses. I worked very closely with a Republican neighbor to the north, Rob Bell, who also serves Albemarle County, on criminal justice reform, because we both care a lot about protecting domestic violence victims and lowering court debt so it doesn't trap people in poverty. I think I've got a proven record of working closely with Republicans, especially when it comes to combating the corruption that I think plagues both parties in Richmond. So I would look forward to continuing that work no matter who's in office next year.
Mr. Hamilton, how do you work with the other side?
Well, there's going to be some issues that I think there'll be some wiggle room. And we just have to keep the communication open. And that's what I plan on doing. I think we need to, you know, especially on marijuana. We can work, you know, I certainly work with the Democrats in expanding marijuana business in the state, discussing how we revamp, medical care in the state, vaccine rollouts. I'd certainly work with the Democrats on that and a few other issues.
Delegate Ferris, chance Virginia will have a divided government next year, perhaps. How will each candidate work with the other side? What do you say?
You know, Bob, it's funny. Sally touched on a little bit, but she and I, along with the rest of the General Assembly, or at least the House, voted 95-98% of the time. I don't know exact numbers. We voted alike on legislation, and that's because a lot of work goes in before these bills reach a vote. And I'm proud of the fact that I've worked so hard with the other side, Sally, and so many others. Even after I was removed from the Ag Committee, I was thanked by the Democrats that supported the animal rights legislation that I worked so hard with them and got passed. And I'm proud of the fact that the Speaker has put me on the Joint Subcommittee on Health Care, which is certainly so important right now. I'm on the Martin Luther King Commission, and I think that shows that I think what the people of the 59th district and all over the state want is people that will work together and try to get something accomplished for the state of Virginia. And so I'm proud of what I've done in the past and really look forward to continuing to serve the people of the 59th district.
Thank you, Delegate. Dr. Moses, both sides working together.
Well, you know, as a physician, I walk into the room to take care of a sick person. I don't start out asking if they're a Republican or a Democrat. I just get to work trying to fix the problem. Same thing when I was in the military, you know, when I would walk into a room full of leaders, and that's frankly what the House of Delegates is. It's a room full of leaders. It's people who have been asked to serve their constituents as leaders and get problems fixed. I have an extensive experience, 10 years as an officer in the United States Army, being in that room with leaders that come from very different backgrounds, have very different experiences, and often have different opinions on how to get the job done. But the fact is, I've got a lot of practice at being in that room and making sure that we take everybody's experience and put it together to find an equitable solution for everybody. I greatly value the experience that my future colleagues in the House of Delegates have, both Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike. And I think that the best way forward is to respect each other's experience in that way and ensure that all the work we're doing is focused on helping each individual Virginian.
Mr. Sicily.
I consider myself a thinker. I get along with everybody, as my opponents might have already noticed. I haven't done anything on my campaign crazy. I believe, again, we got to work together. If we can't work together, nothing gets done. And it seems like that's been going on far too long. My goal is to get along with everybody. You might have your own opinion, and that's fine. But always do what's best for the people. And that's my belief. If I get into office, I'm going to do what's best for the people. And I know both sides are going to come to you with their ideas and their thoughts on certain things. But in my heart and in my mind, if I don't believe it's the best choice for the people, I'm not going to push for it. because that's just me. And it's been going on far too long, and we need to change that now. So that's my beliefs.
All right. Thank you, sir. Here's another question from the Q&A. What is your stance on third trimester abortions? Start with Dr. Moses. What is the law on that in Virginia? I am not sure.
Third trimester abortions are not legal in Virginia, except in the case of immediate or imminent harm to the immediate life of the mother. So that it's not legal. That's the law.
All right. Thank you, sir.
If I can jump in, Mr. Beard.
Please, Sally.
It's also worth noting that there have been two third trimester abortions in Virginia since the year 2000. In the last two decades, only two people have been in the critical situation that Dr. Moses describes. Any woman who carries a pregnancy that long wanted a baby. And so if they find themselves in that terrible circumstance, it's impossible to imagine how that decision could be made any easier by legal restrictions. That's a decision that needs to be made by a mother in distress, in consultation with whoever she trusts, including medical providers. But I think it's also important to recognize statistically how extraordinarily rare third trimester abortions are, but how much political oxygen they consume, that they are designed to distract and divide us from the more essential conversations about widespread access to reproductive care for all Virginians.
Thank you, Delegate Hudson. Here's another question from the Q&A. What are the candidates going to do to support our veterans? And we'll begin with Delegate Ferris. What needs to be done to support veterans in Virginia right now that isn't being done right now?
Mr. Beard, one of my mentors in life was my great uncle, Jasper Ferris. He was wounded in World War II. And he told me stories about him and another man, him and several times, and spent multiple days in a foxhole defending this country. And I think our Second Amendment is the reason that we hadn't had to live those things in this country. But again, I have no more support and no more love in my heart than for men and women that did things like my Uncle Jasper and the mental health that they have went through, come back from seeing the things that my opponent, Dr. Ben has talked about, has got to be tough. And I think we need to do all we can do to support them, not only in their physical health, but their mental health. And, you know, one of the first forums I was ever on after I was elected, I said that mental health is no different than physical health. In fact, it could be, I'm sure it causes a lot of physical health. And I think it's important that we support them in every way we can financially. But I think we need to do more for their mental health. You hear about living, you know, the survivors living in the streets and our veterans. And we know that's got to be a mental health issue.
Dr. Moses, you are a veteran yourself.
I am, Mr. Beard. Thank you. So, as I said before, I served for 10 years in the United States Army. And one of the hardest jobs I had, but also the most rewarding job I had, was working in the Warrior Transition Battalion. And that was where my job was to oversee both the complex medical needs of soldiers who are wounded, ill, or injured beyond the ability of their home units to take care of them, but also to oversee the medical and health care, as well as other transitions from the military on active duty into their status as veterans, as I now am a veteran myself. And in point of fact, I am a disabled veteran. I know what it's like to go from being on active duty in our military. I know what it's like to have the support system and the structure that the military offers. I know what it's like to trade my duty and responsibility and my promise to lay down my life for that of others in exchange for a set of guarantees that I'm going to be protected, that my family is going to be taken care of, and that I'm going to have an opportunity to rise up in this world. Right now in Central Virginia, in the 59th Legislative District, there are around 1,000 veterans, of which I am one. Unfortunately, because of the size of this district, the land area, and the population density, the density of veterans is too low to be recognized as a high need area for veterans healthcare services. It's actually considered a white zone. So there are not enough density of veterans, even though there's clearly enough burden of illness and need for us to have more veterans healthcare services here in Central Virginia. But I think we need to relook the way that we get services to veterans, including health services, education services, and as Delegate Ferris said, mental health care services are critical here.
All right, thank you, Dr. Moses. Mr. Sicily.
I mean, I agree with Dr. Moses on what he was saying, but there absolutely should be no reason why all veterans shouldn't be treated equally and given the care that they're needed, mental care. Delegate Ferris had mentioned about homeless. Nothing hits home more than seeing someone on the side of the street asking for money that's a veteran. And to me, it shouldn't be that way. There should be no homeless veterans. There should be no one out asking for money that are veterans. We should be taking care of our veterans. And I see that there's a big need to change, I guess, laws and really get people involved more to fix this problem. It's been going on way too long. I was in Northern Virginia for many years, and, you know, I've seen a lot of military veterans homeless when I was on the police department, and I would ask them, you know, and not all these people had mental issues. A lot of these people were just down and out. So it's not always mental for the reason of being homeless. A lot of these people don't have family around. They don't have money. They can't find jobs. So not all of them have mental issues. We definitely need to take care of our veterans more now than ever. We ask a lot of them when they go in. And again, I thank Dr. Ben Moses for his service. But we definitely need to take care of our veterans. And it hasn't been, to me, it hasn't been up to par. So,
okay, thank you, Mr. Sicily. Delegate Hudson, what do we do to support veterans in Virginia?
Well, one of the things that I value so much about serving in the General Assembly, as Dr. Moses said, is the extraordinary diversity of past personal experience that we have. And as you've probably already heard tonight, as an economist, as an educator, I have a lot of thoughts about education. I have an eye for accounting, but this is an issue where I so look forward to the prospect of serving with someone like Dr. Moses, who, as a physician, as a veteran, is the expert on this topic. So I would underscore so much of what he's already said about meeting the physical and mental health needs of our veterans. If I could add just a little bit from the perspective where I encounter this question in workforce development, I think a lot of it has to do with how we can help our veterans transition into thriving employment. Some of that has to do with easing the transfer of credentials from the skills that they've picked up in their training in the military, making it easier for them to fast track into jobs where those skills transfer, and also being really sensitive to the needs of their families as they move around the country, easing the burden of licensure for spouses who may be teachers or nurses or working in another profession, making it easier to settle in Virginia, in this place we call home. Virginia has so many large epicenters, especially in the Hampton Roads area and in Nova, for settling our veterans. And I think it's important, as Dr. Moses has already highlighted, that we make sure that those services are available in every corner of the Commonwealth, not just in the areas of highest concentration.
All right, thank you, Delegate Hudson. Mr. Hamilton, what do we do to continue to support veterans in Virginia?
Well, this is an excellent question. I would introduce a bill that would allow for veterans who are homeless to have their rent subsidized so that way they can find a home again. We have a duty, a moral obligation to support those who sacrifice so much to protect the United States of America. So I'm 100% behind that. I'm also for expanding the clinics so that way they can get the mental health that they need. I've met with veterans with psychological issues and they've actually lost fellow folks who they were in the platoon with who had committed suicide. And it hurts them immensely dealing with that. And they need help. My grandfather, Mason Newkirk, he fought in the Korean War, and he was helping building the bridges in North Korea as we're fighting the army up there. But my grandfather, he passed away while I was a teenager. He mentioned the Korean War a few times, but it affected him deeply, seeing the loss of so many friends of his. I mean, war is terrible. So we need to be reminiscent. We need to be an advocate for these veterans. And that's what I plan on doing if I'm elected.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. This is a question about really a national issue. Do all of the candidates for these two districts acknowledge that the results of the 2020 presidential election were valid? Joe Biden is president and are not in question due to any perceived fraud or other irregularities. Let's begin with our Republicans, Mr. Hamilton.
Well, I've mentioned that I was there on January 6th protesting peacefully. I actually voted for Joe Jorgensen in 2020. But even though I didn't vote for Donald Trump in 2020, it doesn't mean that I think that the votes should not have been decertified and that the election audit should have occurred. Democrats, including Sally Hudson, say that no election fraud occurred. Well, that's frankly not true. I've been on several meetings with Senator Amanda Chase and other officials who've mentioned, you know, in areas such as Arizona, there's ballots with similar markings, but different ballot numbers. There's people who don't live in a certain county, but end up voting there. And there's all sorts of issues that we'll call that have occurred. And to say that there was no fraud at all is denying the problem that even exists. There is a problem. Every year, there's different levels of election fraud that occur. But I certainly support an audit, not just for 2020, but for future elections to maintain the integrity of our democratic process.
Mr. Hamilton, did you enter the Capitol?
No, I did not enter the Capitol. I was protesting outside with my signs.
Did you think about entering the Capitol?
No. Actually, my identical twin brother, who's living in Santa Cruz, California, he called me and said, "Phil, did you hear that the Capitol got stormed?" And I said, "Oh, my gosh, really?" So that I did not know that the Capitol had been stormed until he called me. And I was actually walking on my way to get closer. So by the time it got stormed, it was before I actually had reached the Capitol. But no, I had not thought about it. I disagree with those who did. That should have not, definitely should not have happened. That was definitely taking the protests way too far. I used to work at the National Security Subcommittee in 2006. And I had never imagined that me as a former intern of the House of Representatives under Congressman Tom Davis, that the building would get stormed in the future.
Delegate Ferris, your opinion on the so-called big lie that's, you know, in the press everywhere.
Hey, Bob, you know, it's funny. You have to have an ID to buy a vehicle. You have to have an ID to buy property, a land, to open a checking account, a bank account of any kind, get on a plane. Mr. Sicily has a pawn shop. You have to have an ID to pawn something, but you don't have to have an ID to vote. And I think that's something Democrats took way too far. And if we want to talk about, was the election done right? I think that's something we've got to roll back and got to work on. Nothing is more important than a fair election, and not having an ID to vote, in my opinion, is a big problem that I think we need to address.
Are you saying that the election should be rolled back from 2020? Is that what you said?
No, sir. I think we need to roll back legislation that the Democrats have passed, allowing us to vote without an ID.
Delegate Hudson.
So my simple answer to the question that was posed is yes. Joe Biden is the duly elected president of the United States, and that fact is not in question. Every election, the Virginia State Board of Elections conducts an audit after the fact. Our audit results were released in March of 2021 and found no evidence of voter fraud. And I think that this idea ought not be up for debate. I think that it's important that anyone who puts their name on the ballot commits to respecting the results of these safe and secure elections. And if you can't do that, then you should find another line of work.
All right, thank you. Dr. Moses.
I think it's objectively safe to say that we have the most secure elections in the world. And I don't think that that is news to anyone. I think that's been the case for as long as I've been a voter. I think that being unhappy with the results of an election is a common experience. The White House has gone back and forth between Republicans and Democrats as long as I've been alive. And whenever one wins, the other party voters tend to be unhappy with the results. I think that it is patently false to suggest that there's a problem with our actual election system. Yes, President Biden was duly elected and is our president. And no, I do not believe that there was any fraud or irregularity.
Thank you. Mr. Sicily.
Well, I'm just going to come out and say that nothing's perfect. To say that there was no fraud at all in our election is outrageous. And we can always do better. And I think there should be more checks and balances during our elections. Like Delegate Fair said, you know, you have to have an ID to do all these other things. But, you know, when you go to vote, you don't have to have an ID. And my question is, why not? Why wouldn't you have to have an ID? If there's nothing that's fraudulent with our elections, why wouldn't you have to have an ID? So I disagree with probably a lot of people about this, and I'm speaking the truth. I believe there's room for improvement, and there should be more checks and balances to make sure we all get the votes that were given to us and that they're counted. So that's my opinion on that.
Okay, I do have something pointed out from a board member from the Senior Statesman from the Heritage Foundation.
And actually, there's one thing I wanted to mention.
Can I say something real fast? In the period between 1988 and 2017, 1,852 people voted illegally in Virginia 7,474 times, a rate of 258 illegal votes cast per year since we have an election each year. Mr. Hamilton.
Well, as other candidates have mentioned, well, I disagree with Moses. We don't have the safest. We don't have the most secure election because we don't have a mandatory voter ID law. Delegate Rob Bell, I saw him speak back in 2013, and he talked about the importance of maintaining a voter ID law. And I never imagined that the Democrats would go and abolish that. And to maintain the integrity of our elections here in Virginia, we must have voter ID. And it's despicable that any of the Democrats defend this.
Delegate Hudson.
We're still going around again. I guess we can do another round.
Lord.
If you'd like to respond to that.
You know, I actually think that this should be case closed. I think that people are ready for us to talk about the serious work that we would do with public servants as public servants, and that election 2020 has long since been decided.
Thank you.
I would like to bring up something about the protests real quick, if I may.
Sure, go ahead.
I just want to say peaceful protest is fine. And no, I didn't go. I did not go to the Capitol. But the fact that someone's going to, you know, break the law and do things and hurt people, I'm not a big fan of that at all. Peaceful protest is fine. But when you start breaking into buildings and hurting people, I draw the line there. And that's just where I stand on that. So I want everyone to know that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sicily. A question from the Q&A. What will you do to expand affordable housing in Virginia? And let's begin with Delegate Ferris. Delegate Ferris, affordable housing.
You know, that is a tough problem in a lot of areas in Virginia. And I have been very much in support of the government funding some programs to help people stay where they're at. However, the market controls affordable housing. And I'm all in favor of a strong economy, and that's what controls what most people consider affordable housing. And so to not want our businesses to succeed and not want progress is something that I have to support very strongly. And I understand my biggest problem is that people that own a fixed income at the end of their life on Social Security and retirement, and when we raise taxes that they have to pay in order to keep their property and stay in their property, again, that is something that we can do something about on a state level by tightening our budget up and making sure we fund these programs within the counties, with law enforcement, fund teachers and schools, so the counties don't have to step up and do it and raise their property taxes.
All right, thank you, Delegate Ferris. Dr. Moses, what do you do to expand affordable housing?
I actually think that in part I agree with Delegate Ferris on one particular thing. It is a bigger economic question. It's not just about the number of housing units that are available. It's about the safety of those units and the way that people get to them. And a lot of that has to do with the way that we address people's access to education, the way that we address people's access to jobs, training, apprenticeship programs, the way that we address our healthcare system, because so many people, unfortunately, in this country have found their way into situations where they couldn't afford the housing they were in anymore because they were saddled with major medical debt. And so I think that answering the question on affordable healthcare on affordable housing is part of a much larger question and looks at the way that we all stay safe and healthy in Virginia. And we have to take the approach of seeing it as part of a bigger system.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Moses. Mr. Sicily, what do you do to expand affordable housing?
I agree with Dr. Moses. It's a bigger picture that we need to work on to help people. I know the rates right now are really low on properties, and I know that a lot of people with the job situations can't afford their houses anymore. And a lot of that's got to do with taxes, and we just it needs to come from the top. We need to really work on that. So,
all right. Thank you, Mr. Sicily. Mr. Hamilton, what will you do to expand affordable housing in Virginia?
This is a multifaceted issue. Right now we're seeing a shortage of many of supplies, including, lumber and other things. And we have to focus on domestic production. We need to build more things in America so that way we don't have shortages, which don't end up affecting housing prices. Also support getting rid of certain zoning laws so that way new home buyers can buy a home at a cheaper price. It's cheaper to build such a home. But this is a bigger issue. It ties to education. And Virginia, we need to expand school choice. We need to have it so that way if parents live in counties in the state that don't have good public schools, that they can take a voucher and then apply it to a private school so that way their child can be educated elsewhere. Parents deserve to have a choice in Virginia. And the better the education that the next generation gets, the more likely they'll be able to afford housing and to have better housing in the future.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Delegate Hudson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Beard. I'm glad we got onto this question because this is a question that I actually hear from constituents every single day. I think that supporting the development of affordable housing is a collaboration between local, state, and federal government. And so it's important for us to talk about what exactly the General Assembly can do, because a lot of the nitty gritty of housing policy happens at the local level in our city councils and our county boards. I think broadly speaking, what the General Assembly can do for our local governments is to provide funding and flexibility and efficiency. And here's what I mean by that. It's absolutely true that we need more funding for Richmond for the development of affordable housing, for deeply affordable housing, because there are some people who will never be able to afford their own housing, people who are disabled, permanently disabled. And there's a real shortage of those deeply affordable units in our community. And if you talk with the Department of Housing and Community Development, as I did last week, they're pushing really hard in the next General Assembly session to double the size of our housing trust fund so that we can make those critical investment. So that's one part on the funding side. There's got to be more money in the system. The second is for the General Assembly to grant flexibility to different communities so that they can authorize the kind of development that they need, because the affordable housing needs in Campbell County are very different from the affordable housing needs in Charlottesville. But because we're a Dillon Rule state, the hands of the city councils and the county boards are often tied to do that kind of well-tailored local policy. It's why one of my top priorities in my first term was carrying and passing a bill that authorizes Charlottesville City Council to do more targeted and incentivized inclusionary zoning so that we can subsidize those developments here and get that kind of density that we need in pockets of our community. And the last piece that I would highlight is efficiency. We've got 133 cities and counties, each with their own permitting processes, some faster and some slower than others, all very confusing to developers. And when I talk with developers, the number one thing that I hear is that what's slowing down their projects is the uncertainty and the delays about when those projects are going to move through the various gates. And so if the state can help our localities develop more efficient permitting processes, we can make everything more predictable, because when it comes to real estate development, time is money.
All right. Thank you, Delegate Hudson. This kind of segues into a question from a from the Q&A. Is there any hope of getting rid of the Dillon Rule in Virginia? And we're going to begin with Delegate Hudson. Would you like to answer that?
I sure hope so. And I would love to be part of leading that charge. I've actually been working very closely with some of the local government lawyers at UVA Law about how we can start to build the bridge toward home rule reform in Virginia. I think that in many ways it's outdated for our needs. A partial step in that direction that would not require a constitutional amendment would be a legislative solution that would authorize what we call the power of initiative, which would say that if the state code is silent on an issue because it's a brand new topic that has not been confronted yet by the legislature, the localities would have the right to try something new on a temporary basis and then wait for the next General Assembly session to come around to affirm their support for that. Let me give you a really concrete example that makes sense in the confines of Charlottesville City. We had a new innovation come to town a couple years ago in the form of electric scooters. Now, even in the 400-year history of Virginia, the General Assembly had never regulated scooters before. And so there was nothing on the books to talk about what cities could do about electric scooters. That's a great example of how the Dillon Rule handcuffs our city council, because it was something brand new. Of course, there wasn't any state law on it, but the city council had to wait for almost a year to come around for the General Assembly to act. So I'm considering carrying legislation in the next year, which would authorize cities the opportunity to act in the interim to take the initiative to regulate things like that on which the state code is silent.
Okay, thank you, Delegate Hudson. It is getting up to 3 o'clock, so we have time for quick opening closing statements, from everybody, maybe a minute, why people should vote for you. Let's begin with Delegate Ferris, sir.
Hey, Mr. Beard, thank you, and thank you for everybody that participated in this call, and thank you for everybody that watched this Zoom meeting. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate everybody's votes and confidence in the past, and I'll continue to do a great job for you in the future, and look forward to doing that job. The 59th District is big, and it represents a lot of people, and I think I've done a great job of representing everyone, and I look forward to continuing to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Delegate Ferris. Your challenger, Dr. Moses.
Thank you, Bob. Mr. Beard, thank you again to all the other panelists. I think this has been a tremendous discussion that I'm really grateful to be a part of. My goals in serving the 59th Legislative District and all the people in Virginia as a member of the House of Delegates, really to address so many of the issues that we have with access to health care, to ensure that we see a really robust economic recovery for all Virginians, and to make sure that we facilitate so many of these things with broadband infrastructure here in the 59th Legislative District. I think that my experience as a soldier in the United States Army has brought me perspective on a lot of the values that matter to people throughout the country, but especially here in Virginia. And I know that my time and experience at the bedside throughout the COVID pandemic has given me a very specific lens into the ways in which many people in our Commonwealth and here in Central Virginia have been hurt. And I really look forward to working hard for each and every one of them. And also I'm really excited to work with the other members of the House of Delegates. I think we've got a lot of great work to do ahead of us.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Moses. Mr. Sicily, please.
Yes, I just want to say thanks to everyone on the panel and for you inviting me in. I want to say that this year is hopefully going to change things. We see more and more people stepping up, running for office that have never been in politics because they see a need for change, real change. And my goal is to really work on the things that I mentioned, which is the small businesses, broadband, healthcare, as well as for the schools and the teachers. And that's my goal. And again, I'm running as an independent. I think we need more. The Democrats and Republicans need to get along better because that's the only way we're going to start really fixing things for the people is to have the Democrats and the Republicans get along. And again, I'm running as an independent and hope that you'll vote for me on November 2nd. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sicily. Mr. Hamilton.
Yes, I'm the first Republican to run in 16 years in this district, and I am advocating for a different voice that hasn't been heard in Charleston in a long time. Last year, during the riots that occurred with Black Lives Matter and with Antifa and other groups in Richmond and other parts of the state, the Democrats actually tried to push a bill that would reduce the felony charge of assaulting a police officer down to a misdemeanor. In fact, I believe the Democrats were encouraging violence by trying to push such a bill. And I would take a stand against that. I support the police. I support qualified immunity. But I also believe in police reform. I think we need to have a zero tolerance body camera law so that way any officer who is charged with who ends up not wearing a body camera while issuing an arrest warrant, a search warrant, is dismissed from duty. And I think the public is demanding that. And Sally Hudson said that she is independent. But the truth is, she was not outspoken when the parole board scandal came out. There was a murderer who came out, kidnapped a 78-year-old woman many years ago, abducted her, raped her, and then killed her. And she was released without the family being notified. And there were other issues with the parole board. Yet Hudson was silent about this. And let's not forget about Governor Blackface. What he did, he should have resigned. And she and the other Democrats, basically allowed him to stay in power. And he had a image of himself in a Ku Klux Klan uniform. And it's disgraceful that the Democrats have protected the governor for this long. And even McAuliffe said that he should resign. However, McAuliffe has done an about face and is now, supporting Northam. So let's remember the candidate who's going to fight against Republicans and Democrats, who's going to fight for term limits, who's going to fight for integrity. I am your man.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Delegate Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Beard. I would just end by emphasizing the extraordinary progress that we've made in the last 2 years and how important it is that we keep up that momentum. I think I've developed a reputation for being a very practical and accountable and accessible representative, and I would be honored to earn the right to continue that work. If anything about our discussion today has spurred additional questions or comments for you, I hope that you'll reach out. You can find my contact information on many different platforms at sallyforvirginia.com. I want to thank everyone for joining, for tuning in today, and I sure hope we'll have a chance to gather again in person someday soon.
All right. Thank you, Delegate Hudson. You have been watching a forum from the Senior Statesman of Virginia for Delegates 57 and 59. Please go vote. You can vote early right now or on Tuesday, November 2nd. My name is Bob Beard. I want to hand it over to Sue Friedman of the Senior Statesman. And thank you to all of our candidates for appearing today.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you again to all of our candidates. We cannot hear the participants, but they are, of course, expressing their appreciation via applause as well. Thank you to Bob Beard for your third candidate forum. We appreciate that. And finally, the Senior Statesman of Virginia is now 25 years old, providing educational and engagement opportunities for seniors so that we are informed and make the best voting decisions we can, both on candidates, but also on issues. As an example, our program in November is, what exactly is climate change? So we're going to start that topic discussion. Finally, if you are not a member of Senior Statesmen of Virginia and you would fit in with Bob and I and Jeff and as part of this organization, in other words, you're a senior, my question is, why not? Join us. You can find more at Senior Statesmen of Virginia. Thank you again, everyone, and have a great day. And remember, November 2nd, vote before or on. Thank you.